From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, survivors confront the former sports doctor who sexually abused them.
We have seen women weep. We have seen their parents next to them cry. There's really no words to put around this kind of a mourning.
The human toll of the Trump administration's decision to revoke temporary protected status for over 200,000 Salvadorans.
They never say nothing about cancellation. I know this. Not forever, it's not a green card, but anyway, it is a chance, and we take it.
Toledo's mayor hopping the bus to work.
The system has struggled, and I said to myself that maybe the best thing that I could do is try to lead by example.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I've been coming for you for a long time. I've told counselors your name in hopes that they would report you. I've reported you to Child Protective Services twice. I gave a testament to get your medical license revoked. You were first arrested on my charges. And now, as the only non-medical victim to come forward, I testified to let the world know that you are a repulsive liar and that those treatments were pathetically veiled sexual abuse. Perhaps you have figured it out by now, but little girls don't stay little forever. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world.
That was Kyle Stevens speaking today in an Ingham County courtroom. She's one of nearly 100 women and girls giving their victim impact statements during the sentencing hearing for Larry Nassar, the former Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics sports doctor. It's the first of 4 days of survivors speaking directly to the man who sexually abused them under the guise of medical treatment. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been covering this all day. She's with us now via Skype. Kate, what words would you use to describe the atmosphere in this courtroom?
I don't think anybody who's here has ever seen anything like this. I mean, you just heard Kyle speak to Dr. Nassar. You know, she was abused from ages 6 to ages 12, and her parents at first didn't believe her. And she's talked about feeling that her father committed suicide in part because of the ramifications of finally realizing that she had been telling the truth. You heard from a mother whose daughter committed suicide 10 years ago. In part, she believes because she was abused by Larry Nassar as well. We have seen women weep. We have seen their parents next to them cry. There's really no words to put around this kind of a mourning.
And Larry Nassar, how is he responding?
At first, he was not making eye contact with anybody. He was covering his face. At certain points, he was closing his eyes. And then at one point, about midway through this morning, one of the victims said that she believed he actually was remorseful because in his previous statement, she said, "You used the same voice that you did with me when you were at your brother's funeral." And Nassar began to cry. And since then, he has not covered his face. He hasn't really made a lot of eye contact with the victims, but he's at least looking up and looking around the courtroom.
Are any of these women, Kate, directing comments also to USA Gymnastics or Twist Stars or Michigan State University?
Yes, many of them. One of them actually said that she holds Michigan State University just as accountable as she holds Larry Nassar. We heard from one young woman and her parents who are especially outraged that Larry Nassar was allowed to keep working at Michigan State University in 2014 while he was still under criminal investigation. She says that she was abused by Nassar for the first time, basically right around the same time he was allowed back to work, and they feel like MSU has failed them.
Now, we know that this will all lead up, 4 days of this will lead up to Nassar being sentenced after pleading guilty to 10 counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. Do we have any idea what that Ingham County sentence will be?
Yes, actually. The judge gave us a hint this morning. She says she's going to stick with the plea agreement, which means that Nassar will get here anywhere between 25 to 40 years. Now, what that does is that essentially means that if they stick with the plea agreement in terms of sentencing, he cannot withdraw his guilty plea. If she gave him more years than that, he would be able to say, you know, that's beyond the plea agreement. I'm going to withdraw my guilty plea. So she says she doesn't necessarily like giving him that sentence, but that she wants there to be some closure in this case.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells will be covering this sentencing hearing all week, and we will be checking in with her here on Stateside. Kate, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. When Amazon calls, cities jump. And that's the lesson we learn in reporter Chad Livengood's new story for Crane's Detroit Business. Chad and co-author Kirk Pinho plowed through more than 1,800 pages of documents to construct Detroit's response to Amazon's request for bids for a second headquarters, HQ2. Chad Livengood is with us now via Skype. Chad, what were you aiming to do with this story?
Well, we wanted to kind of take the readers kind of behind the scenes a little bit of what was going on. How did this strangely public economic development project come together? Because this was different than most projects where a city gets approached by a business that wants, you know, real estate and tax incentive options and, you know, some information about the labor pool and education level to fulfill its needs. This was a process where Amazon puts out this public request for proposals and sets off a continental feeding frenzy where every major city basically is, you know, vying for the chance of getting 50,000 jobs and $5 billion of investment. And so Detroit officials, as we kind of learned from the, it was 1,800 pages of emails that we got via the Freedom of Information Act, and also just several interviews with a lot of the key players here. What we learned is that this was kind of a disorganized group of people to begin with, and there was a lot of competing interests. You had suburban leaders who said, hey, we got some vacant office parks we'd like to offer up or spaces for office park, like the old Northland Mall site or the Pontiac Silverdome. You had people in Flint. They wanted to put together a long shot bid. You had folks in Ann Arbor who wanted to have some kind of role in this. And then you had the officials across the river in Windsor who said, hey, we should partner together. And so what we found in the emails is how this kind of all kind of quickly came together when there wasn't a lot of time. I mean, this was not a prolonged multi-month engagement with a company like a lot of these types of economic development projects are. This was, you got 6 weeks to give us your best plan. And so what we found was, you know, there was a lot of back and forth in the email traffic of how to do this, who should be in charge, or who should basically lead, and what, from the start, Mayor Duggan basically, you know, enshrined this responsibility on Dan Gilbert, the billionaire owner of Quicken Loans.
So Dan Gilbert basically became the commander in chief?
Yeah, for better or worse. But there was actually sort of an army component to this. It's funny you mentioned that.
Well, that's because, what I got from reading your story. It's like, okay, we got the commander in chief, and then we've got the captains, we've got the lieutenants, because it reminded me of the preparations for D-Day. You know?
Well, so this top aide and advisor to Governor Rick Snyder, Rich Baird, who is a confidant who is always kind of on the ground when there's ever involving public-private partnerships. Rich Baird is almost always involved. And Rich summoned together a group he called the Amazon Field Generals, included himself, Jeff Mason, the CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, Dave Mazeron, the chief operating officer and top aide to Mayor Mike Duggan, and Jared Fleischer, the top lobbyist for Quicken Loans and one of Gilbert's lieutenants. And so they had calls every other day at 8 a.m. for 5 weeks straight, trying to keep this large organization going. They pulled together a couple different consultants. They had a guy in Seattle who kind of provided on-the-ground type of Amazon intel and knowledge for them on how to present this, basically sort of speak Amazonian, as
yeah.
I say, and talk to directly to the world's second richest man, Jeff Bezos. At the time, he was second richest. He's back and forth with Bill Gates these days for the top spot, but that was Gilbert's initial pitch to Duggan about why he should lead this is that, as he said, I know Bezos, I know how he thinks.
And they have
they've talked to each other over the years and gotten to know each other at a conference out in Idaho every spring that they cross paths at. So it kind of adds to the knowledge base of how to basically write to a specific audience of one, really.
And as we read in your story, Dan Gilbert actually got some FaceTime with Jeff Bezos as all this was going on. Tell us about that. What do we know about what the two talked about?
Well, so a couple of weeks after the proposal was submitted, Bezos and Gilbert crossed paths at the LA Summit, this big star-studded gathering of CEOs and athletes. As Gilbert describes it, he didn't use the opportunity to give the elevator pitch for Detroit, but he simply wanted to get to know Bezos better. So he asked him about his company culture. And Amazon and Quicken have a lot of similarities when you think about the company culture. Amazon disrupting brick and mortar retail, and Quicken disrupting your normal neighborhood banking for mortgage lending, using lots of paperwork and in-person interactions where everything is done on a cell phone now, for both buying, you know, on Amazon and getting a mortgage from Quicken. So they talked about company culture. And then according to Gilbert, Bezos brought up Detroit and kind of complimented him about that. And, you know, we're kind of left wondering now, what did that really mean? And that's something that people will probably think about for a little bit. And as we're sort of waiting to see whether Detroit can win this sweepstakes.
Not just here in Detroit, Chad, but cities, as you say, across the country, there was this feeding frenzy, business and political leaders dropping everything and in a lot of cases leveraging the farm to curry favor with this corporation looking for jobs and investment. What do you make of this, like how this process of economic development works on the ground?
This story gave us a chance to kind of get a behind-the-scenes understanding of how these kind of things come together, because there's, you know, economic development agencies are always kind of chasing after these ones. And we had two big ones last year. There was this, and there was the Foxconn plant that Wisconsin won. I mean, it definitely intensifies them. Now, there's some good criticism out there that this is just a lot of placating to a couple of large corporations in essentially writing up, you know, checks. And we don't know for certain how much the city of Detroit and state of Michigan actually offered Amazon in tax incentives, because they have withheld that information. They redacted it from the records. I imagine they'll keep it redacted until Amazon decides one way or another.
Chad Livengood's story, the bid for Amazon HQ2, is in Crane's Detroit Business. As always, thanks, Chad.
Thank you.
Coming up, as more farmers put down roots, some wonder why people should farm in Detroit. For money, societal change, or both? Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Urban agriculture can be seen as a solution to a bunch of city-centric problems, from vacant lots to a lack of green space and food access. With its long history of urban farming, Detroit can serve as a national model of just what urban agriculture could look like. As more farmers choose Detroit as a place to put down roots, some are wondering what the future of urban agriculture will look like. Paige Flager from WHYY's The Pulse reports.
A few miles from the heart of Detroit's downtown, sandwiched between diverging freeways, is a sort of microcosm of the city. A factory, a boarded-up warehouse, and a handful of homes surrounded by the kinds of sprawling yards usually associated with the suburbs. Gloria Duncan's kid is petting one of the neighborhood's many stray cats on her front porch.
And I love, you see the cats going to my porch, I love them cats. Oh, here come one, that's yellow.
She bought her white farm-style house in 2007 for $3,000. It overlooked a huge vacant lot across the street, and for a long time she worried about who might buy it and what that might mean for her neighborhood.
We didn't want condominiums over there because we felt like we wanted something quiet over there that we could trust. There won't be a lot of bad stuff going on.
Yeah, lots of new people in the neighborhood. Yeah. And
you know how they can change it real quick.
But after a decade of worrying, Gloria is excited about her new neighbors.
Welcome to the farm! Yay! We bought land.
Ryan Anderson is giving his family a tour of his new for-profit farm. He and his business partner, Hannah Clark, purchased about an acre of space with the help of a $75,000 loan. They want to expand, but for now, the farm is modest. About 20 rows of produce and a tent-like structure called a hoop house.
So we've got some salad turnips and Asian greens.
Ryan and Hannah sell their produce to a few higher-end restaurants in the city, part of the local food movement sweeping Detroit and the nation.
There's so much demand that I'm not really worried about not having somewhere to sell things. It's much more scaling up our production, which is great because then it makes a big community. All of the farmers in the city can support each other because we don't have to compete for making sales.
Ryan moved to Detroit because he wanted a farm in a city, and this city is uniquely suited for urban agriculture. In terms of land, Detroit is huge, big enough that you could fit San Francisco, Boston, and Manhattan inside of the city's borders. And a portion of that land is vacant, at least the size of Manhattan, if not bigger, and that's space that could be ripe for growing for a pretty reasonable price. Detroit is already home to a lot of gardens and farms. One group estimates that there are more than 1,500, from individual, community, and school gardens to larger scale farms. But for those who are new to the city and new to farming in it, Detroit can be a really complicated place to navigate. I talked about that with Malik Yakini.
If you're not aware of the context in which you're operating, if you're not aware of the social and political dynamics, if you're not aware of the last 50 years of struggle for black empowerment in the city of Detroit, and you just fall down out of wherever you came from, and you plop in here and you say, well, I'm here and I'm going to do farming, and you don't have any idea of the context you're operating within, then you're likely going to move in a way which is not going to be supportive of community goals and aspirations and perhaps could even undermine those.
Malik is the executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. He's a native Detroiter and the founder of D-Town Farm, a 7-acre nonprofit farm.
There's different models of urban ag in the city of Detroit, and we're definitely rooted in the social justice, racial justice, economic justice camp. We're not doing this for profit, and so building a sense of community and advancing certain principles and values is the core of our work, really, and perhaps that's even more important than how many tons of food that we grow.
More than 35% of the city's residents are living below the poverty line, and many households have uncertain access to food. So farms that have been in the city for a long time, like D-Town, place a lot of importance on social justice and something they call food sovereignty, a right to healthy food and a right of the people to define their own food and agriculture systems.
We're hoping that the main seeds that we're planting are not the squash seeds or carrot seeds or tomato seeds, but the seeds in people's consciousness so that they see we have the ability and also the responsibility of providing as much food for ourselves as we can and controlling the way in which that food is grown and making sure that the profits from that food is circulated within our community as opposed to being extracted.
D-Town has events every month to engage residents in farming and cooking techniques. They're planning on opening a co-op grocery store equipped with a teaching kitchen and lecture space.
So this isn't just something that we're talking about. People can actually come out here and see massive amounts of food being grown and see it being grown by a Black-led organization and by primarily Black people who are out here working. And that's a rarity. That's a rare in America. It's certainly a rarity.
In the rest of the country, farming is more than 90% white. But Detroit is a city that's 80% Black, according to the 2016 census. Ryan and Hannah, the new for-profit farmers, are aware of this history in Detroit and say that they were expecting some conflict. Their goal is to eventually be able to contribute to social justice efforts in the farming community. But first, they say, they have to make a profit.
Selling to restaurants allows us to both create a financially sustainable business and provide healthful, hyperlocal food to our neighbors, kind of subsidizes that ability.
A lot of people and developers are eyeing Detroit as a business opportunity, and urban farms could make neighborhoods more attractive for gentrification. That's making some young farmers like Nick Jones think twice about buying land in the city limits.
You know, part of the reason I started thinking about, like, maybe I should buy land outside the city was that, yeah, I didn't want to contribute to completely, like, upheaving a neighborhood and displacing people. If that's indeed what's happening, I don't really want to be the spearhead that drives into the neighborhood, you know?
Intentions matter, he says. These urban farms add a lot to their neighborhoods, but they may become magnets for development. That makes him wonder if the farmers that saw the city as a financial opportunity will have more incentive to sell than to stay. For Stateside, I'm Paige Flager.
Time now to check out some music from Detroit area artists. As always, our guides are Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and its executive editor, Khaled Badi. Let's jump right into the first of today's three artists, Detroit MC and producer Nolan the Ninja. Paul, tell us about him.
Yeah, Nolan really got his start in, well, his first release was about 2014. And Nolan is unique because he not only is a MC, but he also produces his own beats. So it makes him a really interesting person in the game. And he is from the west side of Detroit. And he's really been pulled into this genre that is recalling of, you know, maybe like 90s kind of New York, that real like boom bap, like head hip hop that we're used to, you know, kind of glorifying. And so he discusses growing up in like the Soulja Boy early 2000s era of hip hop, and like the South was kind of starting to become a thing. And he was still reminiscing over the raps of like Jay-Z and Nas and Wu-Tang Clan. So he has a lot of inspiration from that. And you can hear in his work that that's the direction in which he goes.
And Khaled, I know his album was DMM's number three album for 2017. Tell us about it and what put it up there in the top three.
I think Yen shows that his development over the last few years. He's been a really prolific artist. He put out a couple of mixtapes in 2014 before putting out his first proper debut in 2015, Expletive the Hype. And that came out and established him as a real talent to watch in the Detroit hip-hop underground. And it was furious and had this ferocity that he later matched with a lyrical prowess on his next album, 2016's Heart. And that's where you see his technique and his ability to really spit bars and deliver on a lot of what Paul just mentioned, which is that boom bap sound, that New York City sound, the East Coast sound. But then he, like, on this album, expands the sonic palette and it welds all these influences from all over the map. And that's where I think he went into another level on this different echelon. And that's what really scores him on that number three spot.
All right, then we're going to take a listen to a bit of a track from this album. And this is Exodus. I pray I don't become a victim of greed. I'll stick to the creed. Because the dollar couldn't modify my eye.
and promise. I put that on my madre, back spoken like Kanye. Celebratory Moet as I play the Jhonae. Posted in my Nike joggers, put the feet up on the phone with celebs. Talk about what we gon' link up. Ghetto dreamer, the grandeur of life.
Paul, how do you describe Nolan the Ninja's sound? I mean, where does he fit into the hip-hop scene in 2018?
Yeah, and like throwing back to kind of what Kyle was saying is that like familiar kind of hip hop sound. But he really has kind of brought in these new elements. We hear that on the track that we just listened to, Exodus, bringing in fellow Detroit artist J Prime, and offering that kind of dreamy kind of vocalist work and kind of breaking off from like what you would expect from that like hardcore New York kind of hip hop sound.
And now we turn over to Detroit's Bonnie Doon. Khaled, who's in this group and how long have they been on the scene in Southeast Michigan?
Yeah, Bonnie Doon is, I guess you could say they're sort of a super group, but really it's just a four-piece of band members from local groups such as Tyvek, Growing Pains, but they're coming together and not really in the same garage punk vein as those other bands I just mentioned, but exploring more of an alt-country or alt-folk sound. And that's not something that you typically associate with the Motor City.
No.
But that's what Bonnie Doon are exploring on their self-titled debut.
And Paul, tell us more about this album. How was it received?
Yeah, really well. And like Khaled alluded to, you know, it's kind of a sound that you wouldn't associate with Detroit. And I wouldn't say that Bonnie Doon is a Detroit band. They're just a band kind of from Detroit. And so you can see some of that reflected in their work. But really, the sound is like really like relaxed and I would say like really approachable. And it's really refreshing to hear like a folk kind of country mold in a Motor City, a little Motor City attitude.
All right. And this is the number 6 DMM track of 2017. This is Bonnie Doon's Relieved. What do you like about Bonnie Doon's sound and lyrics? What really speaks to you?
You know, Paul mentioned this. It's really laid back. It doesn't have the grit you immediately associate with Detroit. It has more of a twang to it, more of a backcountry porch sound. But actually, it was recorded mostly in the Russell Industrial Center. And so you have to dig a little bit deeper and scratch a little bit below the surface to see or connect it to the lineage of Detroit artists. But I like that. I like that you get sort of a nice wash of, you know, relaxation and sort of like the coasts. Could be in California that you're hearing this or off the coast of New England. But really, it's off the coast of the Detroit River. And I think that's what I like about that is that it's unexpected. And if there's anything that it connects it to the Motor City more than anything else, it's that you don't know what to expect.
All right. And now we turn to a Detroiter. And I'll tell you, this caught my eye when I learned he'd worked with Paul McCartney. Okay, Paul, who is our last artist today?
He did, Kareem Riggins, and he is a jazz drummer, hip-hop producer, a DJ, also a rapper, and as you said earlier, he did play with Paul McCartney in concert for Kisses on the Bottom, and he also has worked with Oscar Peterson and Norah Jones and Donald Byrd and a bunch of really famous people. He was the band leader for Common's band, so he has a lot of roots in hip-hop, but certainly like a really wide palette.
Having this kind of list of collaborators, Khaled, that must inform his music in a lot of really interesting ways.
Yeah, his resume is really illustrious. It's got some big names on there. I mean, in addition to the ones we mentioned already, there's those fellow Detroiters from J Dilla to Slum Village that he's got on there that connect him to his hometown. But I mean, you name it, he's worked with them. Everyone from Diana Krall, Kanye West, Esperanza Spalding, I think Norah Jones was mentioned, all the way to when he was 17 playing drums for Betty Carter. So he's got like connections all over the musical map. And I think that's so wonderful about him is that he's able to bridge worlds like mostly jazz and hip hop, but he connects them in ways that are so thrilling to hear. And you don't really find that too often that you have crossover artists that don't feel focus grouped. And this guy is the real deal.
And so what we hear, this LP, Head Nod Suite, 29 tracks. This guy, this guy's a workaholic, I think, is he? That's a lot of output. We're going to listen to DMM's number 10 track from 2017. This is Kareem Riggins featuring Jessica Caremore, Sweet Poetry. So, Paul, how much does he work in Detroit? How do Detroiters see Kareem Riggins a lot, or is he crisscrossing the world working with Kanye and McCartney?
Yeah, I would say he might be tougher to find playing in Detroit because of all of his big name collaborations and just kind of how busy he is, as you mentioned earlier. But I think the strong connection he has to the city of Detroit is he's actually the son of a keyboardist, pretty renowned keyboardist named Emmanuel Riggins, who played with Marcus Belgrave. And Marcus Belgrave, you know, he was part of the Ray Charles touring band and played for every Motown artist under the banner of the label. So he really was kind of born into a musical world, and he took his own kind of path as well. As Kyle had mentioned earlier, he joined a band with Betty Carter at the age of like 17. He moved to New York City, and I think he's really just found his own path that way. But super close with Jay Dilla towards the end of his life, and he credits Jay Dilla with giving him his first hip-hop production spot on Welcome to Detroit, which was in 2001.
So, and I can tell you really like this guy's work.
I mean, how can you not?
Like, yeah, I know. Yeah.
I mean, if he doesn't tickle your fancy in some way, with all of those connections, with 29 tracks on this album.
There's something for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Well, you can learn more about today's featured artist and many, many more. Just go to DetroitMusicMag.com. And as always, we've been talking with Paul Young, who's the founder and publisher and executive editor, Khaled Body from Detroit Music Magazine. As always, thank you so much, guys.
It was great being here.
Yes, thanks, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, after 25 years living in the United States, a Salvadoran mother now faces deportation and the possibility of leaving her three U.S. citizen children behind. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Once a week, the new mayor of Toledo gets himself to work by hopping a city bus. Mayor Wade Capsicavage has promised to take a Toledo Area Regional Transit Authority bus to work once a week for his entire term. Mayor Capsicavage is here with us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Why are you doing this?
I am doing this to really facilitate a community conversation about public transportation. Our public transportation system in Toledo is not as robust, I think, as it needs to be. It's a system that has struggled in recent years. It struggled to get its levy passed. It is supported in a number of ways, but not the least of which is by a vote of the public. And I said to myself that maybe the best thing that I could do is try to lead by example. Now, the city of Toledo does not provide any funding to TARDA. There's no ordinance we could pass to alleviate whatever ills it may have. But I still felt that by starting this sort of a dialogue, we could benefit from it. I mean, and just for a number of reasons, I believe that the cities that are going to win the future are those cities who figure out how to provide public transportation in a meaningful way. I know the millennial generation, has embraced public transportation. There's all sorts of data and evidence that they're putting off getting their driver's license until they're in their 20s. This contrasts, you know, to my experience. I mean, I'm 45 years old, so that puts me right in the middle of Generation X. But we just need to do better when it comes to public transportation.
And certainly that's a conversation that is consuming us in Southeast Michigan as well. And I know TARDA tried to switch its funding mechanism from a property tax to a sales tax, which would bring in more revenue. And that proposal did not make it onto the 2017 ballot. Why was that, do you think?
It was rejected by one of our suburban communities for placement on the ballot by a 2-to-1 vote. And there's a lot of reasons to go into that. And I don't want to speculate what they may be. I'm hoping that the reasons weren't either race-based or born out of the perception that only lower socioeconomic classes take public transportation, though that could have been some of the reason. I do know that for TARDA to succeed, it has to be seen as a way for middle-class people and folks of all backgrounds that would be something that they can use. And right now, I worry that it is only seen as a mode of transportation for those who are disadvantaged economically. Our newspaper locally editorialized recently that TARDA needs to decide what it is. Is it a social service agency directed mainly toward the poor, or is it a public transportation system that can lift folks of all demographic groups higher? That's part of the discussion, I suppose, that maybe my ridership is promoting. I know what I believe the answer needs to be, and we just need to get there. Look, this Amazon.com HQ2 proposal, one of the things, and they were very specific, as you might recall, on the sorts of things that they were looking for in a city that they were going to choose for their second headquarters. And there were a number of things, the size of the international airport, the access to markets. But one of the things was, is there a robust public transportation system?
And we had that was the big issue here in the Detroit area as well.
Yes, and I mention that now to say that is an indication of the future and where the future is headed. And these dynamic companies that are forming or helping to shape the future of our economy embrace public transportation and, in fact, demand it. Millennials demand it. And cities like ours that struggle to find that mix when it comes to public transportation are going to struggle. So that's why I'm doing it. And it has been a wonderful experience thus far. I've done it. This is my third week in office, so I've only done it a couple times, but I'm going to do it many more, and the benefits are endless. You know, it's a great opportunity to sort of prepare for the day and send those last couple emails during the 15 or 20 minutes that I'm heading to or from work. I think we could all use a little more exercise, myself included, goodness knows. So the least I can do is to try to lead by example like this once a week, and that's what we're going to do.
Toledo Mayor Wade Capsicavage commuting once a week on a public bus in order to call attention to public transportation in the Toledo area. Thanks for talking with us, Mayor.
Thank you.
In 2001, the U.S. government granted more than 200,000 migrants from El Salvador temporary protected status after a pair of earthquakes struck their country. TPS gave the Salvadorans a way to work legally in the United States, to build lives, to raise families. On January 8th, the Trump administration ended TPS for the Salvadoran migrants. Now they have to figure out a way to remain here legally or return to El Salvador by September 2019. Salvadorans say even though TPS was granted because of the earthquakes, being here in this nation has saved them from the gangs and the violence in El Salvador. Immigration attorney Brad Mays is here with us now, along with his former client, Norma. She and her husband came to the United States from El Salvador 25 years ago. Both have TPS. All three of their kids were born here in the U.S. One is here with us now. Norma's daughter, Kenya, is a junior at Wayne State University studying psychology. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Norma, you've got TPS. You've had all of these years in the United States. Tell us something about the life that you and your husband have built here.
We came here when we was very young. So we decided to stay here and work hard and give to my kids the best we can. So,
yeah, what kind of jobs do you have?
We do floor installations.
Three children?
Three children, yes.
And what ages are they?
Well, my oldest, she's 23. My second one, he's a boy, and he's 17. And my baby girl, she's 9.
Did you have any inkling, any hint at all that Homeland Security was going to end the TPS for you and the some 260,000 other Salvadorans who've been living here?
When the everything beginning, and when I hear the Honduras have canceled Haiti, I know we are next.
And so, when you heard the news that it was Salvadorans, what did you think? What did you feel?
Well, I feel betrayed because Salvadorian, we're here because we don't have no choice. We don't have no choice at all.
Why?
Because our country, they don't give us any chance, any opportunity to grow up, to get some education. The other way, nobody risked their life to come here. Nobody. I risked my life.
When you were granted, Norma, temporary protected status, TPS, what were you thinking in terms of how long it would last and when and if you would go back to El Salvador?
Be honest with you, when they allow to have driver's license, social security, we don't thought they would be canceled. They never say nothing about cancellation. I know this, not forever, it's not a green card, but anyway, it is a chance, and we take it.
And you were 16 when you came here.
Yes.
So you truly did feel like you've grown up here.
Yeah.
Kenya, what about you and your brother and your little sister when you heard this news about this TPS being revoked? How did that hit you?
The day that it hit me, I was sitting on the floor, and I was looking at my phone, and I saw on Facebook that I saw posts that everyone was posting things, and I looked it up, and it was true. I was at home alone, and I sat on the floor, and I just cried. And at that moment, my mom called me like she knew, and I told her that it was revoked. So I was just crying. I was just sitting there and crying. She was just telling me it'll be okay. It'll be okay. So it hit me hard. My siblings right now really don't understand. My brother doesn't really understand. He's just living his life the way it is because that's what we're trying to do, making him feel normal. And my sister doesn't know anything. So I'm basically the one that's suffering the most because I'm their backup. So it hit me hard.
Brad, I get the sense this kind of story that we're hearing is being repeated in homes all over Michigan right now.
Yeah, it is. As an immigration lawyer, I run across a lot of amazing people, but really those who are recipients of TPS and DACA. And we have to remember that these people have been in the United States for sometimes 20, 25 years. In Norma's case, she's been here since she was 16 years old. She's grown up here. She's bought two houses here. She has three U.S. citizen kids. She has her own business. She's paying taxes. So she is a fabric of our community. She is a part of our economic powerhouse. She's part of our social networks. We all are affected by DACA and TPS and the recipients. one thing to remember is that it's not only the recipients that we have to think about, but it's the kids, like Kenya. Now, Kenya's a young woman now. She's 23 years old. Many TPS recipients have younger kids, and there are upwards of 300,000 U.S. citizen children of these TPS recipients in the United States right now. So it affects a wide range and a huge, huge community. As for Michigan, we have thousands of TPS recipients in this state, from Nicaragua, from El Salvador, from Honduras, from Haiti, from Nepal. And all of these people are contributing in some way to our community. There was a study that over 80% of TPS recipients are employed. 87% speak English. So these are not people that are on the outlining of the community, and to lose them would be just a travesty.
You know, as you spell out all the ways that Norma and her husband have built a life in this country, living and working in the U.S. and paying taxes and three citizen children, that gives them doesn't give them any shot at getting a green card?
No, TPS is temporary. I mean, when it was established years ago, it was in response to the natural disaster in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. Now, over the years, it's been re-upped by subsequent administrations because they realized that really El Salvador hasn't gotten off its feet. And in fact, things have gotten worse there. Yes, perhaps the conditions have changed since the initial reason why TPS was given, but there really must be some way to try and solve this problem, to try and keep these people here. It is bad policy to kick out people who have been here for 25 years, who have contributed to our economy and to our community, to just summarily kick them out.
So what options exist for Norma and other Salvadorans?
Well, some people are going to have to leave. And Norma and her husband are in that category of people that may have to just leave. They have decided that they are going to have their children stay here because it's just too dangerous for them to go back. The opportunities aren't there for schooling. As Norma mentioned, it's a very dangerous society. You have to pay rent or bribes to criminal gangs, organized crime to stay alive, to stay afloat. The environment that their kids would be subjected to in El Salvador is just too terrible for them to even consider bringing their kids. So they're stuck with a situation where they have to affirmatively split their family. And that is just an un-American thing to force these people to do.
As people come here through TPS, as you say, it was always renewed. It was almost like de facto protective, here you are. But did you work out in your mind what it would mean to these people when and if the government decided it time is temporary and time is up?
Really, it's only since the Trump administration came in that we've had to really counsel our clients as to what that they need to look at different options. Some may have options, many do not, especially those who are where there's a family where both are recipients of TPS and they both have to leave.
Norma, what kind of conversations as parents have you and your husband had with Kenya and her brother and sister since this news came down?
Well, the first thing, we always say this, education is the key. So we always, always talk about that. Doesn't matter how hard it is, but they have to get a good education. And we did. We saved money for them. We worked hard for them because they are the futures. They are American citizens. We always talk about that. And we say, if we have to leave, I want you keep living the way I teach you. Keep in mind, you are the futures. You are, you know, a parent now because you have a younger sister. And you have to do the same thing that I do for you. I know that it's not fair for her. She's in time where life is good for her. And she doesn't have to have this. And I explain it. I'm sorry to put you in this situation. And I told her all the time, I feel sorry because you're not supposed to do this. But we don't have no choice now.
So, Kenya, I know we're looking ahead to September 2019 for the deadline for people to have to leave. What are you talking about as far as what's next if your mom and dad do have to go?
So, right now, I am still studying, and I am going to keep on studying as much as I can until that deadline comes up. So when that deadline comes up, I have at least a degree, and I could work, and I'll be able to take over what my parents are leaving. If
they were here, I would be able to go on and live the way I'm supposed to be living instead of taking over another, like my own family and raising them as mine. So I have to be the mother and the father to my both siblings and having them grow up under my umbrella.
Brad, do Kenya and her brother and sister as American citizens have any options? I know we kind of agreed that Norma and her husband don't. Is there anything that can be done from the children up to try to keep their parents here?
There is, in theory, a way for Norma and her husband to become green card holders through Kenya, but it may require them to leave the United States and be separated from their children for up to 10 years.
And Brad, do you feel that the American government, federal government, bears any responsibility for this situation?
Again, we have to have sound policy that reflects what we have on the ground. We have many people here, not just TPS recipients, but many people here who have been here for many years, who have been paying taxes, who are crime-free, who have raised beautiful families, who have businesses. We have to find a way to keep these people here. We have to find a way to stabilize that aspect of our community. This immigrant community right now is living in fear. Getting to some numbers as to how TPS recipients and how the revocation of TPS will affect, you know, all 13 countries which are under TPS. And they found that the loss of GDP over 10 years would be $175 billion if all these TPS recipients have to go home. The loss of contributions to Medicaid and Social Security would be $7.5 billion. There would be $1 billion in turnover costs for employers to try and replace TPS recipients. Again, this is a community. These communities, 80% of them are employed. 10 to 15% of them have their own businesses and are employing other people. So it just, the policy has to be sound. It has to reflect what we see on the ground. The fact is that there are many people who are going to be split apart from their families. There are many children who know nothing but America who are going to have to go back with their families to El Salvador. It's just a really, really poorly thought out policy change.
Brad Mays, immigration attorney, and Norma and Kenya, thanks to both of you for being here and sharing your story.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.